We're live on...
everywhere now?
We're live everywhere now.
All right.
So we're back.
Well, except here.
We're both dead inside.
I'm dead inside, so... But I'm live on Instagram and Facebook, which is almost as good.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to episode 6.
Episode 6. We're just, you know, we're just slamming these things out like they don't...
Like they don't matter, because they don't. I mean, we really don't care about...
But the stuff we're talking about matters, and that's what...
I'm not convinced that it does.
You don't think so? I think the book we reviewed, I think most of the stuff that we've reviewed, except maybe Force Awakens, maybe they didn't matter.
Well, I will say...
Punishment mattered. Sisyphean mattered.
Well, the thing is, I do it...
Electric dreams mattered.
That's true. I do it because... Well, you saw my video. Why do you do it, John?
Why? Yeah.
Science fiction, UFOs...
I don't have, I have family that have almost that exact same mindset, but they don't ever ask me about stuff like that. I mean, they used to ask me when I was I used to have a lot of people when I was in junior high ask me why I was getting into, role-playing games. And before that, why do you care so much about dinosaurs?
Was there a role-playing game with dinosaurs in it?
No, but I'm talking about all the weird things that I was in when I was a kid. I was into dinosaurs when I was in elementary school, and then when I got into to middle school, which would be junior high for some people, it was, I discovered Dungeons and Dragons and Tolkien, and so that was that for the longest time. But that was weird. And it's so bizarre because I think this entire new generation of kids who've grown up when sci-fi and fantasy is so mainstream don't understand what the 80s or the, yes. or the 70s, the 80s, and some of the 90s even were like when... it was cause for bullying people.
Yes.
If you get caught with Tolkien in your backpack or whatever. But I never did have, I don't have people ask me that now because I think that it's...
That was ripping off like a movie. But
it really?
It was from Black Hawk Down. Eric Bana, he's like, I go home and people say, Poot, why are you doing? You some kind of war junkie?
That went right over my head.
And he was like, I don't say a damn thing.
I thought you were being completely serious. I can hear people from Ohio talking.
People from Ohio they talk more like Michiganers than they do
really?
West Virginians.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. So, and one of the reasons I want to kind of drop this in here because I get this asked this daily, which is why do you do it?
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I played Dungeons and Dragons and other role playing games, but that's not why I do it. Star Frontiers, Gamma World.
Oh, Gamma World was so fun.
Gamma World was awesome. But one of the reasons why I do it is I love design also. I love the design of stuff. There is Angus McKee and Chris Voss, which I always refer to them. And there's, Jacob Rosalski and Simon Stollenhag. They design really cool stuff. And it does evoke things in the imagination. But also, I'm into, Werner Panton and, Frank Gehry and Ray and Charles Eames, who are all architects.
Right.
Who all debuted things like chairs and other, furniture at the 1928 World's Fair. The reason why I love that is because they were inspired by futuristic stuff.
Yeah.
Futuristic living, which is what the World's Fair was about.
Right.
So I'm not
exactly that's not exactly sci-fi, but it's pretty close. Futurism. Do you think there's a difference between futurism and sci-fi?
I think that futurism is a component of science fiction.
You think so? Okay.
Yes. It's a component, but it's not like everything, and it's its own thing too. But they weren't sitting there going, "Hey, you know what? I wonder if an alien wants to sit in my ball chair." Right. But they were thinking, what are humans going to do tomorrow when they have to travel to space? How are they going to sit? How is there going to be a zero gravity? How are their lives going to be improved by a toaster that looks like Airstream? You know what I mean? That's why I do it, because I'm fascinated by design, by concepts, by science. When you fold all those things together, you get a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
So what do we have today? Welcome back. Episode 6.
Well, speaking about this idea, and we're going to talk about a television show that was on Netflix that has rebooted something from the 60s.
Yes.
Which at the original series, Lost in Space, was very much in that sort of futuristic. If you've ever seen it, I think that most people have at least seen clips of of Lost in Space.
Very campy 60s show.
Very campy, but also it had that sort of 40s, 50s, 60s space futurism style to the set design and the all of the stuff. I mean, the iconic robot of that, which I think that people would recognize. If you saw a picture of that robot, you would know it was something, even if you didn't know it was the robot from Lost in Space.
Right.
And it has that sort of aesthetic, sort of futurism aesthetic from the classic age of, would that be the Silver Age of sci-fi?
I think it would be like the Golden.
Is it the Golden Age still? Silver or the 60s?
Yeah. Okay. We can look it up.
Yeah, we can look it up. We can look it up.
We'll get back to you on that one.
But it's the new version of Lost in Space. I'll be honest with you. I think that I was the one who I watched it and then talked you into watching it, kind of.
No, I was already.
Were
watch
you already going to watch
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you were like, I'm not sure if I want to watch it.
I didn't want to. Didn't know if
I saw your Facebook post, and I was like, I'm totally watching this.
Yeah, and I was kind of, because I'll be honest with you, Lost in Space. I mean, I watched it in syndication when I was a kid. And I just didn't really like it. Pre-Nickelodeon. I'm older than that, dude.
No, I'm saying I watched it in Nickelodeon.
Oh, okay.
Because that was the only place you would watch it.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. But I don't remember where I used to watch it. But it was in a lot of these old 60s programs that would be constantly in syndication when kids got home from school.
Right, Donna
in
Reed
West Virginia.
And...
No, Gilligan's Island. It was like Gilligan's Island.
Oh, see, I'm thinking Andy Griffith. Griffith. It was like pre-Gilligan's Island. Awesome. Right?
Lost in Space would be on there sometimes. And... I don't know, and I rewatched the first season recently after I watched the Netflix, after I binged the Netflix season, just gulped it down, and I was like, no, I was right. I still don't like the original season. I don't like that show. It's just
I didn't like it.
And even when, because I'm willing to look at a television show like that and realize you can't like. Snooty, you know, there's a lot of people like to do this thing and look at these shows and they're like, oh, look at the prejudice of the time, or they want to look at how ridiculous the acting standards were different in the 60s than they are now, and the dialogue
the plot arcs were really simplistic,
and the plot arcs worked a different way. But I'm always willing to you have to go back and judge it on the standards of the 60s. I think just Lost in Space, I don't even like it as a 60s show. Like, and I like a lot of 60s television. I like, all the sitcoms from that era were just, I like Bewitched, and I like
Big Surprise.
I Dream of Jeannie, and I like...
Why wouldn't you? But I will say this, though, about the 60s shows, too, is number one, I watched the 60s shows in the 80s.
Right.
And by the way, television was a giant entertainment desert in the 80s. Okay, it was pretty much like WDCA Channel 20, like Fox, and then like ABC, and that was it.
Yeah, like I remember when the fourth channel came out, and everyone was.
If you didn't have cables.
Yeah, if you didn't have cable, I mean, well, we got cable.
I prayed for a weekday because then Voltron would come on at least.
And yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? So there were, every once in a while, something really bizarre. Like I remember in the 80s, even when we were just had the networks, watching G-Force. Which, at the time, I just enjoyed watching G-Force. Yeah. Now I look back and I go, holy crap, I was watching G-Force.
That was terrible.
It was. But that sort of...
No, I mean, I loved it when I was a kid.
Right,
I'm saying
that sort of animation being on a main on a network, just to me, instead of the typical Scooby-Doo, we're going to reuse the same scene 15,000 times, and that sort of the animation was so rampant during that time. But the fact that G-Force was even on... And sort of introduced you to this idea that, not all animation looks the same.
Yeah.
It's not all this Hanna-Barbera stuff.
So what do you think of the show?
Of the new Lost in Space.
So first of all, what got you to watch the show? Because you were
straight up not going to watch it. Right. And I saw I couldn't avoid it because, the advertising for this was all over the place and just unavoidable. And I said, holy crap, is that Captain Flint? And it was Toby Stevens who, he was on Black Sails, he was also Gus. What's the guy's name? The Bond villain. I might have even my notes here. He was also Gustav Graves. He was in Die Another Day. He was the Bond villain in that movie.
Really?
Yeah, Toby Stevens. But I knew him from Black Sails, which is absolutely one of my favorite series. Also eminently bingeable, and I've seen him. Here and there, he's had a couple of other things, and I just could not. I was like, wow, if they put him in there, then the tone of this is going to be completely different from the tone of the original, and is more. I think it worked out that way. It's much more serious and
I heard rumors that was coming out, and I was like, I might watch that. And then like, it came out, and I was like, oh, it came out, because it went from rumor to like showing up, and then I looked online, and I was like, you know what, I'm probably not going to watch this. I'll probably watch one episode because it's gonna be campy. And then I watched one episode, and then no, what happened was, you know how when you were in Netflix, and Netflix shows you like one thing, it shows you like the preview starts playing it.
Whether
and I was like, oh, I'm watching this. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely watching this. I'm going to watch more than one episode. And then I watched it, and I was like, yeah, I like this.
Yeah, I was giving it the a try simply because of Stevens, because he's an amazing actor. Plus, you know. One of the things I liked about him in Black Sails is he was able to pull together, like, as we were talking, he brings grit and seriousness and even menace into a character. But especially in the arc that starts in season two of Black Sails, which I will not give, watch this yourself and find out what it is, romance gets pulled in there, and he pulls off this sort of this hurt, you know, someone who lost their love.
Right.
And so the he was juggling so many different things in that series, Black Sails series, that I'm like, okay, they wouldn't have hired him for the Lost in Space series if it was just going to be some campy, superficial nostalgia fest.
Right.
They're going to do something with this.
It's not like it hasn't happened, but yeah, you're right.
Right. They're going to do something with it. Well, I don't think he would have taken the role if that's what it had been. That's what I thought. And they didn't. They didn't do that at all.
The guy who played the scientist in that movie, The Titans, like, you would never think that he would be in that.
Well, that's true.
That stinker.
That's
the
true too. That it was, but that was more camouflaged. That I can almost imagine how the Titan looked way better on the page than it did finally when it was put on the thing. But
what are your impressions of the show?
Well,
I mean,
my intuition upon seeing him cast in the lead role were proven correct. It was, I mean, it's not the most genius drama that was ever been on television. But as far as sci-fi drama, it's one of the best ones that I've seen. It still maintains the family, or weirdly, maintains the family-oriented ethic of the original without being schmaltzy or...
like a little jingoistic.
It manages to do it in a way.
It was like the 60s, like, we're the Robinsons.
We are the Robinsons.
We're going to go and conquer space. And it was like, well, you're the Robinsons, and that's cool.
Right. And it was, and you're also the Robinsons who have a lot of problems.
Yes.
The mom and the dad don't get along. As a matter of fact, they're not even together at the beginning.
Right.
I mean, they are together in the sense that they're on the same mission, but they're not together as a couple at the beginning of the, they're still married, I think, but they're getting a divorce.
Yes. Well, he was going to stay on Earth. And they got all cleared to participate in the project to go colonize space, and he was like, "Well, I guess I got to go with
go with
the rest of my family again." But and I'm going to tell this as a side note.
So he went for the kids.
Yes, he went for the kids, and he's like staying married to the kids. So the interesting thing about this, by the way, I will say, is that the female lead, who is the mother of the Robinsons,
right?
They established her as a very strong alpha presence,
right?
Very early.
Yep.
But they did it really well.
And dumbly me, for some reason, my printer did not print her name. The one who plays Maureen Robinson.
Yes, I forget her name too. But I'd like to check
out
her.
I've seen her in other things.
She did a bunch of stuff.
Well, here's some things that she was in. She played House Majority Whip Jacqueline Sharp on Netflix
in
House of Cards, and she played Alma Garrett on a series that also did not print it. I need to buy some new ink.
I'm going to look at it. Lost in Space.
Yep.
Oh, they're giving me the wrong one. Damn it. Okay. Lost in Space.
No, the color one, not the black and white.
Right. 2018.
Yeah, because I don't want to.
I'm looking at her. I'm looking for her name.
We have to shout out to her because she did a fantastic job.
She did a fantastic job, but also a fantastic job to the writers who did not Toby Stevens, Molly Parker.
Oh yeah.
Molly Parker. They did a fantastic job of writing her.
Right.
You know, like I said, they didn't do this really heavy-handed, you know, like Rambo. You know, that totally wasn't her thing. She totally wasn't the Rambo. And in fact, in some instances, one instance, I think she even defers to her husband, is like, you know what, you're right, because this is kind of your right. thing.
After they had a couple of arguments.
Right, after they had a couple of arguments about it.
And then finally she was like, yeah, which I thought was, you know, it's one of those things, you can't have a character who's just constantly beating another character, especially when they're supposed to be partners, at least in parenthood. And I thought that was a good way to allow it. It still put it in her hands, but she did the right thing.
Yes.
Now, I will say that they could have taken this, because there are a lot of characters here, beyond the Robinsons and the robot, the iconic robot of Lost in Space, and of course Dr. Smith, which we'll get to. I think Dr. Smith deserves her own
segment.
Yeah. They could have turned this into a super complex Game of Thrones type thing where everybody, but, and I think I can even imagine people complaining about this, I like the fact that Will Robinson in this was pretty much the same as the Will Robinson from the, there was not much different about him except the fact that he felt like he didn't belong, and he felt guilty for things.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on that.
But that he wasn't the same, or that he...
He wasn't the same. In that he was kind of a yutz in this one.
He was kind of a yutz in the earth. I mean, he was...
Yeah, but he was smart.
Well, that's true.
You know, well, let me walk that back. Okay. In the movie, which was terrible, with William Hurt and Mimi Rogers.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I didn't even want to talk about that. Now you've let that monster...
But he was like a really smart kid, you know? And so they took this kind of kid who was awkward and kind of alienated from the original series,
right.
and they made him into this, okay, he's alienated and awkward, but he's also kind of a genius.
Right.
And I felt like they should have stuck with that part of it, because he was really, like, let me just say, I enjoyed the series.
I
loved it. I'm going to watch season two.
Yeah.
What I didn't like about, but here are some of the things I didn't like about it.
Okay.
Number one was, you're colonists, and these people who are supposed to be out in space, are supposed to be prepared for stuff, and they largely were. They were like, oh, you know what, let's extract this, and let's, like, whatever. But there were some times I was just like, dude, no, you should not be... surprised that this is happening right now.
Right. A lot of times they just seem to be like they didn't know where they were.
Right.
And what really got me, like you were saying, they were very prepared to, for example, study their environment, to get resources out of it, etc. And yet they had no weapons.
Right.
So they were completely helpless to all of the fauna of this planet. And I'm like,
and by the way, all the explanations for why that's the case online are asinine.
Yeah. Well.
Okay. Oh, because they're supposed to be like the epitome of humankind, and like best. No, man, you're going out into space, and there's like space rhinos and whatnot. You need to like have
just,
a gun.
I mean, and because this is a rabbit hole, we could definitely just drag this whole thing down. But it is very much a symptom of people who have enjoyed such privilege and insulation by the civilization that's been built up around them that they don't understand how the universe works.
Right.
And in the real world. And especially when you're talking about science fiction and you're going to a completely alien planet, the universe is constantly trying to murder you.
Yes.
And you have to do things to make that not happen.
I want you to repeat that.
And the idea, oh, the universe is constantly trying to murder you. And that's why we build civilization up around ourselves.
Right.
That's why we don't sleep outside in winter. We sleep in a house that someone built.
Right. And that's why we have guns.
Yeah, the idea that you're going to travel... you're going to get caught.
And by the way, it became a Second Amendment thing online.
Did it?
Oh, yeah.
So that's why you're... Okay.
So we're not going to get into that.
Right.
But
no.
For thematic purposes, you're going to go into... You're going to explore space, bring a weapon.
And just to ease people's minds... What I'm talking about in context of this story is not a Second Amendment issue. Because I'm not talking about...
Neither for me.
Right. I'm not talking about these people's rights to have guns so they can protect from each other.
Right.
I'm talking about the wisdom of taking weapons with you when you are traveling to a completely alien landscape where you have no idea what the dangers are going to be.
Yes.
And that just seemed to me unbelievably... That was the only thing that I thought was unbelievably unrealistic.
So can I insert something here? Because... And this is like a little tiny spoiler. Because they 3D printed it.
Right.
I thought it was a really cool inclusion of technology.
Right.
What?
And then they freaked out about it.
They freaked out. They're like, oh my God. The really weird thing about that is that, like, okay, if you don't want the whole series to be kind of militarized, then 3D print the gun to achieve a purpose and then destroy it. Do you know what I mean? And like we'll print them as needed or something.
Yeah.
But they didn't really address that.
Because clearly if you can 3D print a gun, like for example, the character Don West... who was the mechanic in this?
Mm-hmm.
He was actually a military officer in the original series.
Yeah,
I like this Don West better.
Right,
he's much he is a classic rough character. He's a rogue, and he's got the bravado and the
swagger,
banter and the swagger. And I can't imagine that Don West, especially since he's a mechanic and he would know how to do this. I can't imagine he just wouldn't have printed a gun. It just doesn't psychologically make any sense.
Yes.
Given that he knows, because he's seen some of the dangers that are around the world and the animals that live there. The people are smart enough to put up these fences, these security fences, because they know there are dangerous creatures out there. But then they have nothing to defend themselves with the creatures get past. Because they do get past. I found that to be... That was the one thing that I just thought was... It was psychologically naive to think that human beings would do that to themselves.
Yes.
They're not going
to
do that.
And when it comes to space exploration, I'm a bit more cynical, which is we are going to carry our violence and our issues and our egos into space.
Hopefully,
and
therefore controlled probably, and for a purpose, which is
yes,
defensive.
Yes, but we'll probably carry guns, though, too.
yeah, that's not one.
So that was one of the things that bothered me. The boys' interaction with the robot was cool, but... I think in this effort to make the relationship complex, they harp on it too much. Meaning, like,
yeah.
If I'm like a 12-year-old kid or even like a 12-year-old kid's parents, and I find a powerful alien robot, me and the robot are having a discussion.
Yeah,
and I don't mean like Danger Will Robinson. I mean, where do you come from? What kind of technology do you employ?
What can you do? Yeah.
What can you do? Is your brain positronic? Can I extract it for other use? Can I duplicate it?
Right.
I'm not going to harm the robot if he's sentient.
Right.
But I'm going to figure out do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
no, it's great. We've got a great babysitter. I was like,
they weren't really. Here's the thing, because John and Maureen were not. Oh, just cool, there's a robot. They were worried, they were suspicious about it, but their level of suspicion did not rise to where should have been.
Yes.
It should have been like, that thing's not coming into our home until we figure out what it is and what it can do.
Or at the very least, I would have been like, oh, robot, you have particle beam cannons in your hands. Go chop some firewood.
Right. They were very hesitant to use it. Like, John was... trying to drive stakes in the ground, and when the robot did it for him, he was kind of like, And I'm like,
at the very least, I would have, like, tried to
assert... That's what the word robot literally means, is work.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
But I would have asserted more control over that situation simply to avoid anybody else getting any access to it.
Right, right.
So,
which
my last tiny little pet peeve, which was the hydrocarbons.
Yeah, using hydrocarbon fuel, I mean, that to me, I mean, something else would have been much more realistic at that point. The idea that we're still using hydrocarbons as fuels at that point.
I'm no physicist, but I have to tell you, if you can take enough liquid fuel, out of a ship that its weight's going to shift and go over a cliff, then chances are it's not going to escape orbit.
Right.
Because it's too heavy.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's... So I was like, And also, any hydrocarbon that would be combustible enough would probably melt your skin.
Yeah, like, why are they still... I mean, it's like, we're traveling through space
with our
diesel engines.
Right.
It's like, no.
Can we get a nuclear reactor, please?
Yeah, a nuclear
or fusion reactor.
Or an ion... anyway, there are lots of... Seriously, just go out there and go space propulsion ideas in Google, and you're going to get...
Warp AF.
A lot of stuff, yeah.
That was
a little bit.
I mean, I wasn't like watching it going, "Oh my God, you guys suck." I mean, it wasn't that.
No.
But I was like, "You guys could have done better than this."
That could have been done better.
The ships were beautiful. The sets were beautiful. The
CGI
was beautiful.
Yeah, the CGI
costumes were beautiful.
Beautiful and the
it was a beautiful production.
The interaction, the plot, as far as like the interaction between the characters, I thought was fine. It was believable as a story and believable as dialogue and all that, and I liked it. Like I said,
the dialogue was well written.
Yeah, it was one of
the characters were all well written.
Yeah, yes, they were. Sometimes their motivations were a little off because of the issues that we've talked about with in regard to the robot.
Am I nitpicking with Judy? Am I nitpicky? I would have liked her story, which was, she's black. So the girl who plays Judy is black.
Right.
I love the fact that she's a doctor. I love the fact that she's super smart.
She's the one black girl in the entire Robinson family.
Yes. And there's
explained for several episodes.
It's not explained for several episodes. So I'm not going to, like, harp on that. But her explanation as to why she's black is It's not implausible or even weird, but it was the insertion of it that was awkward. It's like a fly that came here from outside. So her explanation was kind of off the cuff and kind of awkward, right. And I was like, okay. But her character's awesome. I love her character.
Her character's a fantastic character, but they were a little flippant. And when the I don't want to tell why the explanation is, because I think
yeah,
I think that once we brought it up that way, that alone might drag someone into the series, so they're like, what happened?
Right.
But
you're welcome, Netflix.
It was not even a very creative explanation in the sense of unexpected.
Yeah.
It's almost like, hey, we've got this character, we can't figure out why she's a different race than the rest of her family. You grab someone off the street and they would say what came out of her mouth
right.
in that moment. And
right.
It's like, really, that's just not... That was a little bad. But it's weird because there are some things in here that are severe nitpicks of ours and problems, but I still think this is one of the best sci-fi dramas that
I've... I have to tell you, it's not just one of the best sci-fi dramas, it's one of the better written stories on television.
I think so too.
Okay, like I've seen like some of these other things like Legion and other stuff, and I'm just like, dude, the writing is terrible.
Right.
They wrote this story. They wrote the hell out of this story.
Yeah, and like I said, it was. And one of the good things about this, one of the things that's impressive about it, is that they were able to write this story so well, and yet maintain a sort of little hint of that family-oriented '60s type of story writing, which is so hard to get in there because if you go too hard, you end up writing Little House on the Prairie in space. And you don't want that much weight of it. But there was just enough of this.
Yes.
So that
it wasn't about being American, which was implied in the show.
Right.
It was just about being exceptional. But you know the really cool thing about...
You mean in the original show, it wasn't just implied. It was outright stated.
That's
true.
That
Americans were being spied on and sabotaged by foreigners.
That's true.
And it was not even a specified foreign country that Dr. Smith came from. He was just from some other... They never even said. It could have been Russian.
One thing I like about this, though, is that... Everybody's working together, but there was an aspect of exceptionalism, but they still managed to do that and be inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, it was like, well, you're all special because you're smart, not because you're white or black or American or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Everybody who's out here is out here because they deserve to be. There's the Japanese family. There's the Indian family.
Very strict tests.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so, you know, I'm into the meritocracy, man.
Yeah.
The meritocracy of merit. the aristocracy of meritocracy.
What Jefferson would have called the aristocracy of talent and virtue.
Yes.
And as he opposed it to the false aristocracy of wealth and birth.
Yeah.
And I would add charm to that. I would say there's the false aristocracy of wealth,
I know nothing
charm.
About that.
But this was in a couple of letters that he was talking.
No, I'm saying I know nothing about charm.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, the true aristocracy of talent and virtue was on display in this story.
Yes,
they were selecting people specifically for their ability to
at various times you could tell people knew their jobs. They're like, okay, I'm gonna go do this.
Yeah,
so that was cool.
And do you want to talk about Dr. Smith?
I'm gonna talk about Dr. Smith because Parker Posey, who, I mean, I've had sort of a mixed relationship with her, not in real life, but I mean like her roles. And I have to tell you that, like, she stuck this role, man. It was it was the triple axel, and she stuck it. I mean, so Parker Posey plays Dr. Smith. I have no issues with them doing the gender swap with certain roles. This role, certainly not.
No,
this was a fantastic role for that because...
And it wasn't done in a way that was, like, it really didn't have anything to do with gender politics. She wasn't a female, so to prove something about women. It was just, here's an actress who could play this character, and the original Dr. Smith, there was nothing gendered about him anyway.
Right.
He was actually pretty
effeminate dude.
He had no love in him. Yeah.
So
it worked. I
want to like throw this out there too, because Selma Blair played her sister. Selma Blair played Dr. Smith's sister. And she's in the show for like 90 seconds.
Really?
Yes. So Selma Blair, who, you know, she was in Hellboy.
Right.
So anyway, so it was cool seeing her in that. But Parker Posey rocked this role. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm pretty sure that was Selma Blair. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was.
We can look it up.
But one of the great things about Parker Posey was she played this role. This role was beautifully
unbelievable.
Played. It made me so tense and so aggravated. It made me hate at various times watching the show because I wanted to just be like,
yeah.
But the thing is, I realized after...
so bad. She's yes, so...
After like three episodes, I was like, man, it's her. She's doing this to me.
Right.
And the reason why is because they wrote her so well, and she's acting that part so well. She does the original Dr. Smith stuff. But the thing about the original Dr. Smith stuff is everybody knew that he was wormy.
Right.
So they kind of just... They worked to isolate him.
Right.
Here, she just grew with tendrils over the whole cast. And manipulated people and made all this stuff happen, and I was like, "Oh my
fantastic.
God!"
She was fantastic. And she was way better than the original Dr. Smith. And the original Dr. Smith was kind of like a very cookie cutter
Hollywood
old school
yeah.
villain. Where I mean, you basically could have. I mean, I hate to say this because I know there are a lot of fans of the old series, but sorry, the old Dr. Smith was just one of these plug and play villain characters
yes.
from old dramas and. Parker Posey did not let that happen to this character. She
not
was
at all.
Very much. Although I have to say, there was still, like we were talking about, there was still something, some kind of a retro style about her character
yes.
and about her presentation that I think was throughout this. You know, that's a little spice of the old, of something that feels like both in the future and retro. She you know, something. Maybe it was her haircut really struck me as like a 70s.
For me, it was her wardrobe.
Haircut.
Her wardrobe was really like.
But
a bit over the top. I mean, not for the show, but I mean generally.
Right, right.
Which would be good.
Well, yeah, but that's good. That's because that's exactly what
well.
She could do.
Right.
But her character was so manipulative, so convincingly psychotic, and delusional in the sense that she didn't know who she was herself. She actually thought she was a good person, but then she would vacillate and say that she was going to be a good person and that she was going to get over her past. The bad things she did in the past, but then those bad things were someone else's fault, and she just did this spiral
yes.
that crazy people do.
Yeah.
And
I,
well,
I want to drop. I want to drop a little, like space science fiction, like public service announcement into the show.
Right.
Which is, when in doubt, when it comes to who's your enemy and who's not, just space them.
Yeah.
You know, there we have airlocks for a reason. You ever notice?
There's a scene.
Well, I mean, I wasn't going to talk about a scene. What I was going to say is they're called airlocks, but, you know, you don't really need air.
Right.
I mean, to come through those. They're big.
Right.
So people fit in them.
Right.
So I suggest that you push them into it and open the other side of it.
Yeah, that's like a Facebook meme. If you have toxic people in your life,
that
space them.
That, well, I mean, look, 3D printed guns and airlocks.
Right.
Dude,
yep.
Use that. Use okay. it. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, great show. I would recommend everybody, you know, go check it out.
Absolutely, I do think so. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a 5-star show.
No, I wouldn't say it's 5-star.
It's a 4-star show.
It's a 4-star show, but I would definitely, it's definitely worth a watch.
Absolutely.
At 10 episodes.
And it moved several actors' careers forward.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, all the Robinsons, I would say, and some of them, I think this was their first thing.
Yeah.
And several of the secondary characters. The guy who played Don West, who I think, I don't have him down there. But
Judy is her charisma.
Oh yeah, and her sister too, who played the, you know, the rebellious
yeah.
sister, and she yes. did a good job. Judy kind of stole the show.
Yes,
her
she
character
did.
Was a little bit more.
And Molly Parker, I mean, she'll get a good paycheck out of this for a few seasons.
Yeah, because
sure.
so. She did. She did a really strong.
I'm
she
like,
has a need of the her. She has a.
I sort of feel like after watching this show, I want to watch her some other stuff now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, that's exactly why I watched this show, because I had seen Toby Stevens in another show, and then
yeah.
and I was like, anything he's in, I want to see him in it now. And I've seen him in a couple of. There are some actors like that. Like there were some actors in, for example, in Turn, that I am watching another series called Jamestown, because I watched them and they were in Turn, and I they were really good actors. And so that's always a good thing to follow an actor
yeah.
or a writer or a director's career, and.
So we had to talk about this article, or we had to talk about Science Roundup?
Well, what do we got here? What are we looking at? I can't.
Let's rock out the Science Roundup.
Yeah, let's
hit a couple of those.
Science.
Well, we've got an answer, because we talked last
science
time about tidally locked planets.
Yeah, we did.
So let's alleviate the pressure. Let's drill a hole in people's heads.
We did talk about
drain the fluid.
Some trepanning to be done. Here it is.
So we were having a debate about the habitability of tidally locked planets. So we're moving now from the talk about the show to the science roundup, which we like to do. We like to talk about science topics, science
yeah.
facts. And we talked about tidally locked planets, and just as a reminder, tidally locked planets are when the planet does not, in its rotation around its star, does not itself rotate. Therefore,
it rotates in exactly the same amount of time that it orbits, so that it's
fixed. Right. Yeah. So it's right. Okay. Yeah. So there's one side of the planet is always facing the star.
Right.
And there were not only now. Granted, in this article, I did not see a complete verification of your theory.
Right.
But I saw some. There were several other reasons why.
A lot of problems.
Yeah. Right. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So my theory was related to the fact that when you have a huge temperature gradient in a closed system, which is an atmosphere of a planet, and you've got things that are hovering, and I found this out as we were talking about this, I was looking at it online, there are some people who think that on tidally locked planets that the temperature hovers around absolute zero in places on the dark side, which is going to precipitate out pretty much any gas you're going to get in the atmosphere. And my theory is that, when the gases precipitate out, solidify or liquefy on the dark side, the pressure to try to maintain the equilibrium is going to bring those gases back from the warm side, and that's a one-way trip.
Right.
Once it ends up on the dark side, it's gone. So the atmosphere is going to slowly just freeze out or liquefy out on the cold side. So you're not going to have an atmosphere on a tidally locked planet.
Right.
Unless it's very recently tidally locked, which that process takes so long that I'm just going to pretend like I didn't say that. And
right.
Say, no, you're not going to have it on a tidally locked planet. But this is more about
the geological moisture,
process.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you want to? Erosion is one of the factors.
I haven't read this article in a couple of weeks, but you can continue on with it. But first of all, there are several geological factors, not the least of which would be volcanic.
Right.
And it would essentially over time form a system that would perpetuate itself.
Right.
So it's a combination of volcanic or seismic activity, moisture. Erosion from that moisture and from other particulate matter, right?
Right.
So essentially it would make living in that environment very hostile. And also the seismic activity is driven in part by the heat.
Right.
Right. So
and the heat gets the heat on a planet like that becomes so
I came across it on space.com. By the way, if you are a science fiction writer or even if you're just interested in science, check out space.com. They got some great stuff on there. So tidally locked planets, with all the things that we came across on this, I would say, yeah, you're right.
It's
going to be problematic to inhabit or colonize a tidally locked planet.
I mean, we might be able to colonize it in the sense of creating our own little habitats along the rim, but you're not going to be able to do anything on this planet,
right?
So
and seismic activity could really...
The seismic activity could really...
destroy, rupture, habitat,
although
whatever.
Mercury is tidally locked, and it's...
But we don't currently have a colony there.
That's true, but it's not... The volcanic activity isn't the problem there, is what I'm saying. But,
yes.
And
you wanted to talk about ants this time, too.
We keep talking about ants, but
ants
I think ants are a fantastic thing. I was doing some follow-up research...
Ants are fascinating.
...from the last time when we talked about ants, and we specifically talked about how ants triage their wounded in battle.
And they fake being...
They don't fake it so much as they exaggerate it in order to get help.
Right.
And you're really gung-ho about the ants not exaggerating their...
I'm into ants. I mean, I got to tell you... if you had asked me even like a year ago if I would be into ants, I'd been like,
yeah.
But I'm really into ants right now.
Yeah. The thing was that last, was it last week or was it two podcasts ago? Anyway, we were talking about ants, and the bizarre thing is that ants, when they're wounded on the battlefield, will limp more when their nest mates are nearby so that they can get help.
Right.
And so it's like, we were saying it's like calling out for a medic.
You're right.
Medic. And so doing some follow-up research on this just to see if there were anything else. Two bizarre things. First of all, and this is a new one.
I have to admit, though, before you get into that.
Okay.
Like when you first told me about the triage and medic thing, like I was thinking about like the oh my neck, oh my back thing.
Right.
Like, oh my neck, oh my back.
Yeah.
And my neck.
Yeah.
Like I was thinking like an ant was doing that.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Yeah. But no, they're actually wounded, and then they... I think that it can be interpreted the other way, is that when none of their nest mates are around, they really tough it out.
Right.
And then...
They kind of have to.
Yeah, they kind of have to. They're not gold... Is it gold bricking the term?
Gold bricking, yeah.
Okay, so I found two things, and one of them is a new news item, which I don't have a copy of here, but we had discussed this, where ants that are protecting their nests will press their bodies up against invaders until their bodies explode in this noxious, toxic liquid goo.
Right, which, by the way, is awesome.
So basically,
it's very Sisyphean.
It's very much like the book that we reviewed last podcast.
Or should I say Torishiman?
And yeah, Torishiman. And it's essentially suicide bombing.
Yeah.
Is what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're blowing their bodies up in order to kill their enemy. And more importantly, because a lot of people don't know this, but one of the key predictors of suicide bomber activity is when someone feels that their territory is under control of someone else.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and that's like one of the predictors. If you take a lot of societies where different factors are involved, one of the things that sort of ties a lot of that specific type of terrorist activity is when people feel like that.
Is that anthropomorphizing, though? Saying the word terrorist?
Well, as far as ants go?
Just generally. We're ascribing a human activity to...
Yeah, okay, I see.
Yeah, I mean, is that what it said in what, the...
No. Okay. I noticed this. Okay. I noticed that these two characteristics, which were the suicide attack...
Right.
And it happens specifically when an enemy is coming into... I wonder whether there's not some social dynamic about mitigating threats that says, okay, you don't typically destroy yourself to destroy your enemy. But if someone's in your territory,
right,
in your home territory... This is when it becomes adaptive.
Yes.
And that's why there's this mirroring. I hate to say this because it sounds like I'm making excuses for suicide bombers. I'm not. I'm just saying that...
You're equivocating, sir.
Scientifically, this may be a scientific principle that ties these two things together. And I would say this. If it turns out to be the case and we find other behavior in other animals that sort of ties this thing together, what it would do is it would help us to understand human terrorism better and help
counter it. That may be true, but I also say... Aside from that, you're equivocating on the issue of insect terrorism.
I would say this, it's not because they don't have a
I was kidding. Goal I was in doing like a building.
I know, but I don't want anybody to think that I'm not that I don't understand that term is a human term.
Well, the thing is that ants are they are evolutionarily their job is to protect the hive and the queen.
Right.
They have aside from their mandibles and other chemical processes that they use to alert other ants and stuff. They have very little that they can do to attack an aggressor.
Right.
So it seems evolutionarily it makes sense to me. It's not like I would look at that and go,
they're doing that. Yeah,
right.
It makes perfect sense.
Yes.
They use a lot of the things, they're not able to make tools, so
right.
They evolve a lot of chemical attacks, chemical spray attacks, and this is a chemical attack.
Yes.
They're exploding their own bodies.
That's really cool.
Against the enemy.
If you get ant shrapnel in you, that'd be gross.
But even better than that is the other story that I dug up, which is not... recent. It's been around for years, and I don't know how you and I didn't know about this, but ants actually pass the mirror test.
Okay, so tell everybody what the mirror test is.
The mirror test is a standard test that researchers use to try to measure or to try to determine whether or not an animal is self-aware.
Right.
Of, you know, that it recognizes itself as a being. Mm-hmm. And what it is you set up a mirror. And if the creature recognizes itself as not just simply another member of its species, then that it passes the mirror test. And so the way this is usually done is to put a spot on the... To see if the creature behaves differently
right.
toward itself in the mirror
right.
rather than that it does toward other creatures of the same species. But another thing that they often do is to put some kind of spot of paint on the creature that they can't see... without the mirror, but when they see it in the mirror, to see if they go, oh, and reach.
Right.
If they see it in the mirror on their chin, and then they reach for their chin, then they obviously realize that the creature in the mirror is themselves.
Do they put a spot on the ant?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And
the first thing is
an ant looking at itself, looking at its nest mates, or even its nest mates in a mirror, behaves completely differently from the way an ant who is looking at itself in the mirror behaves. It will start to cleaning themselves, grooming itself in the mirror.
An ant grooming itself.
An ant grooming itself in the mirror, recognizes itself in the mirror. But they did. They put dots on the ant in a place where it couldn't see it without looking in the mirror.
Right.
And they would immediately start trying to get rid of it.
Interesting.
And which is a completely different behavior than when they would see another ant with a dot on its face, which is they would behave aggressively toward it. But when they're looking in the mirror and they see that ant with a dot on its face, which is a reflection of themselves, they try to clean the dot off. So they clearly recognize that this creature in the mirror
is himself,
is me.
Interesting.
Which is bizarre, not only because ants have such tiny brains, and you would expect that sort of behavior to not be cheap,
right,
cognitively, but also that ants are such a, they're such, you would never think that an ant would have a need, and maybe this is just a stereotype we have about ants, that they wouldn't have a need for a sense of individual self. But they do have it.
Right. Stop stereotyping ants, man.
Yeah, stop stereotyping ants.
You know, because they're
unfair to ants.
I sort of feel like we should start playing Tchaikovsky for them or something, too. Well, I mean, if they're self-aware, and there may be some other deeper emotional...
Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah, to see if they react.
It sounds like I'm being kind of a joker about it, but I'm being...
No, that would be... I mean, I've seen studies that plants react to different styles of music differently, and I'm just like, why? So that surprised me that ants pass the mirror test, but it does give a lot of credence. You know, I've heard some criticism of certain science fiction stories where, you know, the go-to insectoid species, if something lived in a hive mind, it wouldn't be able to just express individual thoughts.
Right.
Well.
Right.
The science says differently.
The other big question is, you know, because they're so regimented and they're so, like, obedient. So is that the chemical thing? Is the queen just, like, enslaved them with her scent? Or what?
I would have to think that maybe they have...
Is it like the worker from Sisyphean, where he's just beat down, and he actually has a really complex emotional life,
right?
But the scent makes him forget?
I don't know. Oh, it could be that there are different aspects to individualism. Like, one of the aspects of individualism would be that you are an individual different from your comrades.
Right.
Another aspect would be that you're an individual in that you're different, not just in space,
right,
but in interests and all that other stuff. And that's the part that ants don't have.
Yeah. You know,
it's like there's one ant, well, my favorite color is blue, and the other ant, that's my favorite color is green. They all like
different
red.
Stuff. Right.
All the ants, they have like the same color, they like the same food, they do the same thing. And
I think I'm going to just experiment and maybe separate ants from its collective.
Yeah, but they still understand that they are a different creature from their other,
like the Borg, you know? Like, we'll see if they reassert their individualism
by
separating them from, like, the scent trail.
And see if they see what an ant does. I don't know if an ant will survive. I mean, if you put
I'm going to name him Hugh.
So, I don't know. You're going to end up with a dead ant.
That's probably true. I do want to talk about the birds thing.
Here you go.
Oh, okay.
Zebra finches.
Yes. So, they discovered recently...
I read that as a scientific name, Zebra finches, and I'm like, how is that genus named zebra?
Oh, this is the name, and I see
there's zebra finches,
right?
Not zebra finches,
right? Okay. I thought this was the taxonomic nomenclature. This bird, which is called Atticus Rodriguez.
So that's the part. That's the research. We both did the same thing with different texts. We're morons.
We are. So the cool thing about that they discovered about how birds actually detect the magnetic fields, and obviously to navigate.
Yeah, to navigate.
Whatever
I was doing with my hand.
Right. Yeah. and so what they discovered was that there is actually like a protein that they synthesize in their bodies, and it's called
CRY4.
Yeah, the CRY4. I call it the CRY4.
Yeah. So, well, it is worth crying for because it's very interesting.
It is.
That's our pun for the podcast. We have to have one bad pun every time.
Mine was, I had one last month.
Yeah.
And so they're called cryptochromes, and they basically, as the name kind of implies, it affects their sight.
Right.
So they can navigate, you know, using the cryptochromes. And one of the reasons why I want to do this story, too, is because, first of all, people have talked about this forever. Like, they've always suspected that birds had some kind of, you know, internal navigational, you know, whatever. And now they've gotten really specific with it.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I wanted to do, and they say CRY4 is an ideal magnetoreceptor. and as the level of protein in the eyes is constant. Well, the really cool thing about that, that I feel like would be cool, is, and I'm kind of going to go into like a little side thing here, is I want to write a story about that, yeah, but not about birds. No. I want to write a story where humans learn from nature and they take something like cryptochromes and they use it for like navigation in space or in a heads-up display or even in like a, you know, a sniper rifle or something weird like that. Like, that would be really cool.
That would have been very useful in that one story in the nebula that we, the sniper story in the nebulas, remember?
Yeah.
To include that in, like, that would be part of their heads-up display.
Yeah.
Yeah, to see, to be able to see the magnetic fields. And
so I'm going to challenge myself, I think. Just as kind of...
Challenged.
Well, just so we can sort of show people what we're talking about.
Right, but there's not just a, we're not, it's not just cool that we're talking about science. These things actually inform rigorous science fiction.
Yes, yeah. And pursuant to that, I'm going to write a short story.
Okay.
For next month.
Do we have time for one more, or are we where are we at?
Well, we do. We do have a couple minutes, but I'm going to, I want to finish my segment about...
The birds?
Well, the bird segment is finished.
Okay.
But I'm going to write a short story, which I'm going to, we're going to talk about next time. I'm going to put it on the website.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying? So you can see sort of how it's done.
Okay. Proof of concept.
Proof of concept. I have no guarantees about the pros. I'm just going to let you know, but I'm going to write a short story.
Okay.
Okay. So we got one more thing to go over.
So you're putting your keyboard where your mouth is.
I'm putting my keyboard where, yes.
All right. That's a good idea. I can see. All right. This is a fantastic story, and I think that a lot of people have seen it. It's been buzzing around. Apparently, the Bajau people in Indonesia a diving culture, and they've been known for a long time. There are several documentary series that have at some point feature them. So it's I've seen
Boy in a Waterworld.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know, but I'm talking about like in real life. I've seen these people.
Waterworld wasn't a documentary. Bajau,
huh? No, it was not a documentary. It's actually more of a mockumentary of people's inability to understand water volume. But the Bajau people are sort of a well-known people who are really, really good at diving, and it's sort of this mystery how this was, to the point where they've been on, you know, several series about cultures around the world or other things. Will be like, they're the go-to people in that region because of that interesting fact about their culture. Well, what they've found is that they have evolved over however long they've been living this lifestyle, they've evolved larger spleens than the neighboring peoples.
Mm.
And the reason that this is significant is the spleen is part of the part of the body that helps, when you're holding your breath underwater, it helps keep your body oxygen.
Interesting. So, okay.
Yeah. But the fact that that they can directly tie an evolved characteristic to a cultural characteristic, I think it's just, especially in the space of humanity's existence here,
yes,
as human beings, because these are two neighboring peoples who have not even lived there for the entire span of human existence, because the migrations in that area have just been crazy over the past few millennia. So in the space of centuries, this particular microculture in that region
has grown an
organ of a larger size than their immediate neighbors who don't have a diving culture.
It's fantastic. It makes me wonder what other organs you can grow bigger
if you just from practice or from natural selection through. Because I think there are two ways that this could happen. One of the ways this could happen is that the ones who didn't have the large enough spleens drowned, and therefore they didn't have children.
I wasn't even saying through natural selection. I was just thinking.
You mean through genetic engineering?
Well, obviously, I think like part of natural selection is, you know, is use.
Right.
I mean, not everybody who doesn't dive gets selected to dive.
Right.
But the people who dive get selected to have bigger spleens.
But you know what? One of the interesting things is that they also noticed that the Bajau who did not dive in their life and that had larger spleens.
Yeah.
So it's genetic. Clearly genetic. But it's either the ones who didn't have a large enough spleen to survive this diving lifestyle didn't survive long enough to have kids, or they didn't dive and get out of our culture, go marry them out to someone else, or get out of here, and they didn't have kids that remained in this. You know, there are so many ways that selection can do this.
Yes,
but it is interesting to me that this seems to be one of those cases where a cultural practice,
and again,
influenced the natural selection.
The relevance to science fiction, particularly world building. This is where I think this is interesting too, because I love to love science and I like science fiction. Like, you didn't know that. But the thing is that
you should do a podcast that's all about science fiction. I'll help you.
Oh crap! You're right.
That would be a fantastic. We could do it like once every couple of weeks or so.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's on like a Sunday. Yeah.
Do review books and stuff.
But one of the great things I like about this, the pertinences of it, is that one of the things that people oftentimes lack in is world building. And this is a 2-for-1. This is a scientific component that has a cultural explanation.
And you can, there's some nuance in it that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't an adaptation that was forced upon them by their environment.
Right.
It was their culture taking advantage of their environment with a cultural adaptation that then led to the physical adaptation. Just fantastic way of...
And when their sea levels rise, they're going to be like...
Right. Well, but and another interesting thing was, you know what this story reminded me of? Have you ever read Vonnegut's Galapagos?
No, I have this one a few times I haven't read.
Oh, you absolutely should read it, because it's all about humans who get stuck on Galapagos and how it, on the Galapagos Islands, and how it, what they evolve into.
I will read that. Let me go buy that.
Everybody out there that has read that book is going, oh yeah, I see what you're talking about, because it's just so immediate.
Right.
And that's one of my, it's not one of my favorite Vonnegut books, but it is,
it's read-worthy, right.
It is read-worthy.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, I think that, like, so we went through the show, we went through some good science roundup, man, that was really, I was worried.
You were worried?
We have a lot of stuff, but I was worried that we would, like, not...
I think over the last two podcasts, I think that we could have talked for hours about Sisyphean.
Sure.
We could have talked for hours about what the...
Parker Posey.
About Parker Posey's character and what the adaptation of... What these reboots... We could have gotten into what makes a good reboot, when something doesn't need to be rebooted. There's just so much we could... I think we could have talked for hours, and I think that people are probably like, yeah, you see two guys, you can just run for hours.
That's, well, we are. We were like, why don't we do it on like camera? Anyway, so that was a good episode. But thank you guys for tuning in. We really enjoyed having you. We see your comments. We see your likes. Also, don't forget to comment and like Fresh Cult Magazine. You can comment actually. What I'm going to say is comment on the actual podcast in order to be eligible for the loot crates.
Right.
And we'll hook you up.
And we'll do some random.
Yeah. And FYI, the last Loot Crate winners, which is the collectible science fiction t-shirts, those have been determined, and those are going to be mailed out, 4 to 6 months for delivery. No, I'm kidding. It's going to be like a couple weeks.
4 to 6 months. It's like, what decade is this?
I know, right? Snail mail. So thank you for tuning in, and we will see you all next month.